Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all. Hello, listeners. So today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving any of your goals? If you feel stuck in any way, then this is a perfect opportunity for you to try out therapy. I'm a huge proponent of therapy, and I actually see my own therapist twice a week. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your very own licensed professional therapist. So it's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional therapy done securely online. Due to where you live, you know, maybe the kind of help you need may not be readily available. And so this service is a really great option no matter where you live. It's also more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. So to schedule your first therapy appointment, go to betterhelp.com/goingmental to get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp using the promo code GOINGMENTAL. On today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Samantha Boardman. She is a New York-based psychiatrist, socialite, and author of the book Everyday Vitality. She combines her medical training and psychiatric practice with her studies in the field of positive psychology, where she helps her clients cultivate vitality and find strength from within.
I am Samantha Boardman. I am a psychiatrist who also has a degree in applied positive psychology. So I think of myself as a positive psychiatrist.
So what, we can just jump off from there, but what is positive psychology and how would you say it's different from traditional psychology?
Sure. I mean, you know, I'll tell you how I got into it, and that kind of can help explain it a bit. I went to medical school, and in medical school, you really learn to focus on everything that can possibly be going wrong in anybody's body. You know, like, what's wrong with you? How can I make it less bad? And if I need to do surgery, you know, I can excise it. If I need to medicate it, you know, I can sort of dial it down. And then I did psychiatry residency, which was oddly sort of a very similar approach. I think I was hoping to sort of find the answer to, you know, the question, like, what makes a good life? What makes life worth living? And instead, it was sort of, how many milligrams do I prescribe? And how do I dial down people's problems? How can I sort of identify and diagnose something and then make it less bad? And I was out in practice for a couple of years, and I got fired essentially by a patient. A woman I'd been seeing for a few weeks came in, and she had a lot of anxiety. She was depressed, just like overwhelmed, you know, when that feeling of just your like water's getting splashed in your face constantly, but you're just kind of keeping your head above. And she said, you know what? Sometimes like I just dread coming here. I hate it. All we ever do is talk about everything that's like wrong in my life. And sometimes I'm even having a kind of good day. And I have to think about like, what can I complain about? What can I, you know, what's really bugging me? Because that's what we do. And you know what? I'm done. And I never saw her again. And she was right. Like I was so laser focused on what the problems were, the conflicts with her partner, the issues with her kids, her, you know, ambivalence about going back to work or not, like all these things that were like issues and challenges in her life. And we were so fixated on them. And we were never talking about the things that she loved to do or what was meaningful for her or even that was challenging in a good way. And so I ended up going back to school and studying applied positive psychology, which was really like the science of health and well-being. And I had been studying pathogenesis, which is the science, I'd say, of disease and diagnosis. And this was about salutogenesis, which is the creation of health. So studying like resilience and post-traumatic growth and optimism and seeing ways that I could really try to integrate them into my practice of psychiatry. And so that's what I've been doing ever since.
It's so fascinating because I feel like I go to therapy and I've never even heard of the term positive psychology.
And I'm wondering why traditional psychology and treating more of the symptom rather than kind of what's causing the anxiety or, you know, causing the depression is more normalized.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really, apparently it's really been since sort of World War II that psychology became so negatively focused, you know, and it was sort of even trying to search for the root of evil in the brain. And, you know, people started talking about the reptilian brain and that we were supposed to sort of be more evolved, you know, and we often try to think of like science as being outside of culture, but it's actually so embedded within it. And the questions we're asking, the, you know, studies we're initiating and like what we're pursuing is so deeply embedded in, I think, this cultural context that we don't really think about. And, you know, the biological model in psychiatry became really prevalent in the past 20 years of, oh, there's a problem. There must be a brain issue. Is this a neurotransmitter problem versus, you know, sometimes looking more at the whole person and their environment and what they're in. And maybe it's both, you know, and I think positive psychology, and I'd say by extension, psychiatry is kind of trying to look at the human being within the world that they exist in and the environment they live in and the body they inhabit, and trying to also within that create wellness within illness and even strength within stress.
Yeah. Have you seen a shift just from when you were in med school to now in your practice with the studies that they're doing in terms of brain chemistry and, you know, nature versus nurture?
Yeah, no, you know, I'd love to say more of it. There's a lot of research now. I mean, I think if you Googled, you know, on the Google Scholar, the word resilience 20 years ago versus today, you know, you'd see a lot. And positive psychology has really exploded. And sometimes people are critical. They're saying, well, this is sort of rainbows and unicorns. And I would, you know, respectfully disagree with that. I actually teach positive psychiatry to the residents at Cornell. And I get like they're curious about it, but actually where I get more even, I think, interest and engagement is from like the surgery residents and the medical, the internal medicine residents who are actually curious about how that can help their well-being, you know? And so I think that's where we're sort of seeing the interest in it a little bit more. And I'm heartened by that. I think we have a long way to go though.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think burnout is very real amongst, I mean, I was just talking to a friend yesterday who I ran into and her boyfriend is in residency right now. And she's like, yeah, he's going to be in residency for 7 years before he gets his first job.
It's really stressful. And I think there's actually been a recognition of what like frontline workers and even, you know, medical students and residents are faced with. And it's something that maybe in my day, I think it was sort of like that grit your teeth and bear it mindset a little bit. You know, but at the same time, I have a friend of mine who also helps, who runs the training program. And he said also, it is going to be stressful for you. Like, don't expect that it's not stressful, he tells the incoming class, but it's going to be stressful and also simultaneously incredibly meaningful. And, you know, trying to kind of find that balance. And I think of Ellen Sachs, who's this extraordinary woman who was diagnosed with schizophrenia when she was 19 in college, and she had a psychotic break. And her parents were told at the time, you know, take her out of school. It's too stressful. Maybe she could, you know, she could be a clerk somewhere. She could work at a garage or something, you know, like that. And her parents said they'd accept her diagnosis as schizophrenia, but they wouldn't accept this sort of prognosis of a life that she couldn't sort of pursue her interests. And so they sent her back to school. She had support. She had financial support. Her parents were willing to, were able to, you know, find a good doctor for her, to have her on medication and to have therapy as well. And she ended up graduating. She ended up going to Oxford. She got a degree. She is a lawyer now, and she's now a champion of mental health law. And she says that how it's just been this incredible experience finding meaning and challenging and meaningful work. And she has a colleague who also has schizophrenia, who also is a lawyer. And when his voices get too loud in his head, he uses his legal training and will say, what evidence do you have for that? You know, so this idea of the incredible like neurodiversity is so valuable, I think, in our society. And as psychiatrists, we, you know, sometimes we tend to, you know, just that sort of, oh, take all the stress out of your life kind of prescription is sometimes undermining, I think, what is meaningful to some people and what helps them, you know, what helps them thrive and feel strong and find that desirable difficulty, and also be with that, be these incredibly contributing members to society and you know, to the world.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And also, what came to my mind is, it's almost destigmatizing mental illness or mental health, saying, okay, you can be an active part of society. You have a lot to contribute, even if you have voices in your head. You can't get out of bed sometimes, X, Y, and Z, and also showing yourself that you can do it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And obviously for everybody, it is different. And you know, where is that sweet spot of desirable difficulty where you feel like you are, you know, being pushed in a good way and you are being challenged in that positive way to help you sort of get better. And, you know, there's sort of three pillars in psychology that are theorized to be these three pillars of well-being. And one is, you know, a sense of autonomy that you have agency and you're able to make decisions. The second one is relatedness, the sense that you are loved and that you love and that you belong to a larger community. And the third one is a sense of competence, that you have, you know, the ability to rise to a challenge and to achieve what you put your mind to. And I think, you know, for those who have a mental illness, for those who may not, that those sort of three cores or pillars of well-being are definitely something that therapists should have like front and center and that they should be thinking about. So it's not just thinking about sort of, how do I make this person feel less badly about their life, but actually what makes them feel strong?
Yeah. Where is that sense of purpose? I see a lot of similarities between kind of positive psychology and honestly, like spirituality or religion. Do you see a correlation between the two?
I definitely do. And, you know, it's, I write about in the book, you know, like happiness doesn't necessarily or just come from within, it comes from with. And I think that sense of being a part of something that is larger than you are. And, you know, I think probably one of the single best antidotes for stress that we have is doing something for somebody else. And we know that it's a fundamental human need to belong to a community. And, you know, loneliness is an epidemic. And that sense of not just you can have friends, but still feel lonely. And we're often seeing this even in younger people who feel incredibly lonely today. And they might have, you know, sort of air quote friends, but those types of friendships where they feel like they have meaningful conversations, where they feel like somebody's got their back, that they have that sense of invisible support. Like, oh, if I needed someone to pick me up from the doctor, I could call these three people and they would, you know, show up and not ask any questions and they would be there for me. And I think that that social network and that social net that, you know, people know that eating healthy is important or getting exercise or sleeping or whatever, but how do we actually put front and center that social connection and prioritizing that in our everyday lives? It often just kind of falls by the wayside with all the to-do lists and all the stuff that we need to get done, that sometimes relationships aren't necessarily a priority.
Yeah. And so in your research, what works for people to boost vitality and also in your own personal life?
Sure. I mean, vitality was this, again, something that I never studied in medical school. Like it wasn't a word that came up. Like I thought of like Richard Simmons and like dancing to the oldies or something. But vitality, that positive feeling like of aliveness and energy, and that is both physical and mental, and that you feel like you're sort of up to a challenge and that you're ready for anything. And that it really was a marker of everyday well-being. You know, and there were sort of three fundamental ways for me to think about it was, how do you feel like you're connecting with others? How do you feel like you're contributing to something beyond yourself? And how do you feel like you're being challenged in a positive way? And like, I think of it as the three C's like that. And like, you know, with those connections, especially that I think is so fundamental to our well-being and just like little things like feeling like you've had a meaningful conversation with somebody that day. You know, the vampires of vitality are probably our phones, you know, that really undermine even the potential of having like a good shared moment with someone, something that feels meaningful, that every time, you know, even there's a phone on a table, we know it's undermining the quality of the discussion that's happening. And even food tastes less good when, you know, one person's distracted. And if you're eating together, I always love the study of two people eating the same piece of chocolate. And when both people were present, they both enjoy the chocolate a lot. They're both eating the same piece, but there's something about eating it with somebody else that made it even better than when you ate it by yourself. But if one of the people was distracted, then the chocolate, both of them found that the chocolate tasted less good. And so I think fundamentally, like when we're with somebody else, but we're on our phone with our loved ones, if you're in an Uber, wherever it is, you're unsharing a potentially sort of nice moment when you are together. So, you know, how do you want to at least be deliberate about your use of your mobile device? Like, obviously we all need to look at it and we all need to look at it a lot, but maybe when you are in the presence of your loved ones or at dinner or whatever, maybe that's not the moment.
Yeah, I think that's amazing advice. I've never heard of that study. That's so fascinating to me. I like to flip my phone over or put it away in my purse when I'm out to dinner. And sometimes with a few of my friends who are particularly bad about checking their phone during a shared moment, I'll say, you know, if you check your phone during the dinner, you have to pay for it.
So, I love that. Yes, I've heard of people doing it. This one father I knew, he would say brick it, and everyone had to, like, you know, pile up their phone on the table, and the first person who would grab it had to pay. So I thought that was actually a really good, you know, way that, you know, you can use sort of punishment in a way. Yeah. Like, whatever, like, behavior change works. I try to, like, when I come home, I'll leave it in another room. So, like, I call it the tumbleweed factor in the book, this idea of, like, so many things that are kind of happening outside of our control, or we think that they are, and phones are one of them. But so how do we actually take charge of when, how, you know, and where we use them is I think just like this little small way that we can actually have a better day, but also maybe help someone else have a better day as well.
Yeah, I have so many questions that are coming up just in your own life. So you're not very active on social media. I know, particularly Instagram, I think you haven't posted in years on it.
Oh, wait, no, I'm on, now, because I moved it over to positive prescription.
Okay, so you are, but yes. Your personal Instagram.
Yeah.
You haven't used for quite some time.
Yes, true.
But no, I'm wondering if that has to do with, you know, reading studies like that, or just the work that you do in your day-to-day life, and you see the negative effects that it has on people's relationships and psyches, and if that's why you haven't been as active.
No, I mean, you're 100% right. I mean, you know, I don't always practice what I preach, but there I really do. And, you know, it isn't, as someone said, nobody's ever, you know, been on their deathbed and said, I'm so glad I spent so much time on Instagram. You know, like, it is those sort of, and especially, like, we know, especially with young women, it takes about 17 seconds to feel badly about yourself, you know, looking through social media posts like that, and self-comparison kicks in. And, you know, we are seeing this uptick with, you know, young girls as young as 10 with, we know anxiety has increased. We know depression has increased. And some people will argue back, well, that's just because maybe there is a little bit less stigma. Maybe people are more comfortable talking about it at a younger age. But actually, these numbers are clearly real, and you're seeing actually, you know, more visits to emergency rooms for suicidal ideation, for suicide attempts. I mean, these are those numbers you can't argue with. And I think it's super concerning, and you can't say one is unequivocally causing the other, but I think that it's pointing more and more, the research that I've been seeing is that it's definitely, it could be contributing to it, and especially in young girls.
Absolutely. I mean, do you see in your younger patients, do you notice that, like, the more issues and anxieties pertaining to social media in comparison?
Absolutely. I don't see people under the age of 18. I have a lot of colleagues, though, who, you know, children do child psych, and they have certainly seen it. And eating disorders that we're seeing in younger and younger kids. And I mean, it's not just girls, but it seems to I've personally, and I've had friends who've observed it in their kids. I've had colleagues who've observed it in their patients. And also there's young women who are in their 20s who I see, or, you know, early 30s as well, who, you know, are constantly, like, who can't help but turn to that. And, you know, if you have somebody you're dating, and then it's not just that you're hearing they might be somewhere else, now you're seeing it front and center. And it's really painful. And, you know, it's, and do you unfollow them? Do you not? Do you just mute them? Like, how do you kind of go through the process of that sort of extricating yourself and the visuals from your life of that human being who maybe did play a role for a chunk of time and who you maybe had something good with or not, or whatever that thing is. And that it's kind of a hole in your heart every time you open it. And it's not even that you're hearing about it, you're seeing it. And I think our visual cues are obviously so much more powerful to us. And I think it's really, really hard for people to navigate their way through that. And not just that, it's even like text communication, you know, and things like that, that are like so different when you're hearing somebody's voice versus like an emoji, or like, is that like a positive? Like, should I call that person back? Or, you know, all the nuance, and you can't read the tea leaves of the expressions that one would in a phone conversation even.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely changing the way we socialize. I'm very focused, or have been very focused on that in my career. How is social media changing the way we date and interact? And, you know, why are people getting married later and later? And all of these questions are so interesting. And it's, yeah, there's no going back from it. So it's like, how do we make what we have work for us?
Yeah. How do we live with it? And a friend of mine called Jonathan Haidt, who's at NYU, he suggests that for young women or for girls, for parents not to give their daughters a phone or, you know, access to social media until ninth grade. But you cannot have your daughter be the only, you know, person, because that's really hard. But how do you create sort of norms around that? Even, you know, with young people, as I was saying, like, they're, you know, they report feeling lonely and, like, you know, not knowing how to navigate just kind of social interactions, or even awkwardness, or even knowing how to break up with somebody, or, you know, do something that is, you know, how do you sort of have a confrontation with a friend who's done something that bothers you and said, like, they'll just kind of ghost them or ice them or whatever, like not being able to kind of navigate those almost, you know, probably skills you would have learned in the playground that you actually maybe didn't. And especially with COVID, when kids weren't allowed to connect with each other. And then on that sort of social playing field, it's really, really hard. Those just basic communication skills. How do you even disagree with somebody, you know, or without, you know, being rude to them?
Passive aggressive, yeah, or ignore, totally, blocking them, unfollowing them. And you're a mother and you have two. I mean, I can't believe they're this old already. Like, I remember when they were so, like, little babies or like 5 years old. But Vivian's a teenager now?
She's 13, yeah.
13. Oh my gosh. How do you navigate this stuff with your own kids and having two teenagers in the Snapchat, TikTok era, just as a mother?
You know, well, the ship sailed with me. You know, I wish I could have, like, kind of, you know, brought it back, but it's a lot easier to stop something than to, like, take it back once it started. I think that's just a psychology that most of us can relate to. But I, you know, both kids, I think they got a phone in like sixth grade or something like that. And, you know, with COVID, it was a lifeline, you know, especially my son was playing video games with his friends and they were hanging out. And with my daughter, you know, when she had COVID, she was sort of in her room for about a week and TikToked her way through it and like twerked her way through it. And, you know, it's a source of humor, a connection, you know, even, you know, she'll be like, come and dance with me. And I know that's sort of how she relates to her friends and where she is, and just kind of keeping that open level of communication open. And I'll sometimes say to her, because she'll see on, you know, Snapchat, like somebody had a birthday that she wasn't invited to or something like that. And I remember her once thinking, oh, will she be hurt about this? And she looked at me and said, you know, Mom, not everyone's invited to everything, you know? And so you realize, like, actually, like, the wisdom of a child that I was sort of concerned, but she's like, no, it's okay. Not everyone goes, you know? So I just think it's sort of to be there and to be present. And also, I mean, I certainly do have expectations of my kids, and that is to be kind, you know, most of the time, and to whatever you're posting, just make sure you're not making someone else feel bad.
Yeah. Have your views on social media and just, I mean, being a psychiatrist and a doctor, have they changed as you watch your own kids kind of go through that world?
No, absolutely. And I see it as this lifeline in so many ways. And this, you know, and I know especially for young kids who do feel incredibly alone in the world or where they live, like to be able to, you know, go online and find somebody who is like you and that you aren't alone, who maybe doesn't exist in maybe, you know, the small environment that you live in, or that people can listen to you, Eileen, and hear, you know, this sort of, you know, your perspective and what you know, what you speak to, you know, the people you interview about and about your own experience, like the generosity and that sharing, those kind of role models you can have outside of your immediate community or family or something, I think is so powerful and so beneficial. So, you know, I see that side of it. And then you also see then this sort of self-comparison, self-loathing side of it too. And so it is creating that balance and it is here for us. I know, like, one thing, and I've always tried to tell my daughter this is, you know, whatever you're seeing, especially when you're scrolling through Instagram or Snapchat or something, just know that that's somebody's highlight reel. Nobody's really, you know, posting like, you know, this is me with my pimple, unless it's sort of like an airbrush, beautiful looking pimple, you know, and even that kind of fake humility and something isn't, it's just know that you're looking at a presentation of something and it's not necessarily real. And I think that just always when you go into it, no, it's just, it's fun. But also it's really key, and the studies show this too, is for young women especially, is to, when rather than just passively scrolling, like that you're actively engaged then. Like you are the person, like you're commenting, you're posting yourself rather than just kind of scrolling through other people's lives.
Oh, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Yeah. That like passive social media use seems to be far more toxic and detrimental than actually active social media use. Like where you are commenting back to your friends, you're engaging in conversations, you're posting yourself, and you know, you're, you know, actively using it versus just kind of like looking at it passively. And I think that that seems to be the type that is more connected to that kind of feeling horrible about yourself and feeling lonely.
And the comparison.
Yeah. Well, I think you become like a bystander, like a spectator in life. And that feels very, again, like it's the opposite of doing that thing of connection. And I think social media is at its best when it's connecting you and you're feeling like part of a community. But when you're just feeling like that bystander and you're feeling isolated, that really amplifies that sense of loneliness.
Yeah. And you're sitting at home and you're like, wow, I'm on my couch while all these people look like they're having the time of their life. And I wish I had their life. And I think that can become like a toxic rabbit hole very quickly.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I would love to just talk a little bit more about your personal upbringing and yeah, where you grew up, maybe a little bit about your family.
Sure. Yeah. I grew up in Manhattan, and I, on the Upper East Side, I went to an all-girls school, and I was there until eighth or ninth grade. You know, I was pretty sheltered. Like I didn't know what was out there at all. And I went to a boarding school that was co-ed that was much more of a sort of trial by fire. I think having been really lucky to go to an all-girls school, I was kind of surprised by, you know, the boys didn't study as much as I did. And, you know, I was never the smartest girl in the room, but I could outwork anybody, you know, and so I could like stay up late and do like, I would read everything 10 times. I mean, I was sort of that like kind of type A, but like, you know, in a perfectionist kind of toxic way also, like it was definitely very stressful for me. And I put all this pressure on myself, and my family really had no interest whatsoever in anything academic or scholarly. And I was sort of like this strange creature in their lives, because I think they thought I'd be like, when are you getting married, you know, or whatever. Like, so they didn't really see that pursuit. And I ended up graduating after 11th grade from high school. And I took a year off and I traveled and I worked in between. And then I went to Harvard in the following year with the right class. And I started getting this idea that I could study medicine or maybe go to medical school. But I also loved history and English. So I wanted to see where the humanities and science collided. And I studied the history of science. And then I applied to medical school. I had to do all the like the pre-med stuff and to apply to medical school. And it was just, I think I was really interested in psychiatry. I mean, as every family has, you know, we on both sides of my mom's and dad's side, there was mental illness and there were suicides. And I think my initial like, you know, sort of draw to that was maybe if I understand it enough, like, you know, however the genetic dice has been rolled, maybe that won't happen to me. And I think that was, that's at least how I look back on the, you know, you sort of tell the story looking back differently than probably at the time. I never would have connected those breadcrumbs in a way, but this wonderful old psychiatrist once said to me, he said, well, what do you think the purpose of therapy is? And I said, you know, I was sort of an eager beaver. And I was like, well, it's to change your, you know, your present. And he said, wrong. And then someone else said, well, it's to change your future. And he said, no, the purpose of therapy is to change your past. And his idea being that you know, we all have these stories we tell about ourselves and we're so attached to them and what's true and this is the way it is. And my, you know, mother was just, you know, mean or cold, or my father was this, or my, you know, that my sister was the favorite child. And, but part of therapy is beginning to kind of let go or see that like the nuances in the stories that we tell, and that there probably is a lot of subtlety in that and letting go of that really specific story we have about ourselves, and maybe allowing for, you know, maybe some forgiveness or for some understanding or maybe just insight that maybe the story that we are so stuck to, that we're like, this is who I am and this is the way it is, maybe it isn't all true.
How was your own mental health at a young age? I mean, just now you said you were very stressed and good at school and put that at the forefront, but just your general.
I see kids today who there's so much pressure on them, just like even from their parents. And I was so grateful not to have that, but mine was super like self-imposed. But I remember when I was in boarding school having this dream that I would like, I could go home, like I would get sick and I would just be able to be in bed for like a week. And I was hoping something would happen to me. And I actually ended up coming down with the chicken pox in 11th grade. And I went home and it was like this amazing thing. I'd never spent a day just sleeping and being in bed. I think I was so tired. I had circles, you know, that were so dark under my eyes. And I didn't, you know, I was sort of at the time, like I was sort of not eating very much. I think I was concerned about how my body looked and I kind of wanted to be like Little Miss Perfect in every domain. And I was afraid also, I think, to try new things. Like the idea of going to medical school was new, but I was so afraid of failing. And so I think I probably, even when I was in college, I held back thinking, well, if I, you know, take a computer science class, I know I'd fail that and then I'd do badly. Or if I take even like a music, you know, history of music class, I bet I, you know, people who've been like raised with music would understand this better. And so I think a lot of fear looking back held me back from doing things that I wish I had tried, or just wished even like socially I had been able to break out in ways that maybe like I was fearful and that kept me in a certain box. And, I think today I definitely was a perfectionist. I think one of the nice things about getting older is that you kind of get happier with mediocrity and like just like I've made peace with like, you know, there's some stuff I'm just never going to do well. And I'm a little like, I think less afraid of being embarrassed, you know, in some way. I remember my daughter once being like, you know, she was like 4 and wanted me to skip down the street with her. And I was like, that's so embarrassing. What self-respecting doctor would be seen skipping down, you know, Madison Avenue. But it was, you know, that sort of like, actually, who cares, you know? And it's like, there's sort of like those embodied experiences where you realize you just don't care anymore about just, you know, how you look then in others' eyes. And I think that perfectionism, and we're really seeing it on the rise in young women of wanting to be perfect in your achievements and in your social life too, and even holding other people, like wanting them to be perfect as well. And I think, you know, when people, especially young people, young women who I think getting into college or their jobs or whatever, their identity is, it sort of merges with like their character, you know? So like, and their identity is like where they get into school. And if they don't, like that means that they've somehow failed. And like, that's just a part of who you are. And the same thing is like, I think your professional life, like how do we allow ourselves to wear many different hats and be many different even versions of the person we are? And this whole idea of like, you are your profession, you are where you got into college. And I always advise parents to kind of like pull back on that, because there's so much pressure on kids today. And I think that sense of failure or disappointment that if they don't get into where they wanted to go to, or they don't get that job, that somehow not only have they let their families down, but their identity is somehow compromised.
Yeah. And I wonder if it's even more amplified today because you can see what everyone's up to, and you know, everyone posts their college acceptance on Instagram. It's just so much more in your face today than it was in the past.
Well, that's going back to what I say to my kids, like never post anything that's going to make other people feel bad. And like that idea of like, I don't quite relate to that idea of like, I mean, I don't have kids in college yet. I mean, I've got my, you know, my stepsons, but I wouldn't toast that, like, about them. I just think in a way, like, I can toast them and be happy for them and love them and, you know, be proud of them in a way that doesn't necessarily, you know, need to be broadcast out to the world. And that those are sort of family matters. Like, I don't need to say, I've got the greatest stepchildren or children in the yeah. world. Like, I know other people have really great kids too. Like, it's just not that, again, like, I just think you don't want to invite people into that awful space of self-comparison.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is making me remember back when I was in grade school, people would send holiday cards. And I remember there were like a few families specifically that would have like a 10-page letter in their holiday card that would be like, you know, Dylan like hit a home run and Jennifer got into this school and she won the spelling bee and like just this list. And I remember we would sit around the table and I would read it and share it with my dad. And he was like, this is wild that people would share these things. Cause it would just make you feel like, oh my gosh, well, I'm not doing that or my kids aren't doing that.
Yeah. And now you get that like every day on social media. It's funny. I actually write about a patient who is a recipient of all these cards and she was so like overwhelmed. And again, like you're getting these like highlight reels of these perfect people's lives and their skiing vacation and their daughter graduating from Yale and like whatever these, you know, picture perfect lives are. And I'm not sure if this is reassuring or not, but I remember her telling her this about this study that the title of it was "People Are More Miserable Than You Think."
And, oh gosh!
And but as awful as that sounds, I think because when you're seeing all this perfection constantly and you're bombarded with it, it's what, you know, I think a researcher from Stanford called duck syndrome. You know, we're constantly seeing other people who look like they're sort of seamlessly gliding across the surface of the water, and they look like they just don't have a care in the world, and everything's great, and they're great mothers, and they're great, you know, they have this like power job, and they're, you know, also on the side, they like bake and all these different things. But, you know, but actually, like what we're seeing when we're seeing those ducks sliding across, like gliding across the water, is you're not seeing that their little legs are frantically, you know, going at it. And so I think it makes us feel badly when we feel everybody else's life is so perfect. And I was just looking at a study on college students who, they assume that their peers' social lives are much better than theirs are and that their peers are much more popular than they are. When it's because of this sort of what's available to them, which is social media, where you're seeing like, oh, I'm just seeing them. I'm not seeing them sitting alone in their room with nothing to do on a Saturday night. It's sort of salience. It's what you see. And so it probably isn't reassuring in a way, but I think maybe just knowing that not like people aren't as like awesomely happy all the time, I think can make people recognize that like everything is so hard. Like life is so hard, you know? I mean, getting out of bed, like just doing the things you want to do, like some of the basic stuff can be really hard and annoying. And just sometimes that overwhelming thing that is just the last straw that you're like, I can't believe I'm crying because I spilled my coffee kind of thing. And
yeah,
life is, it's really hard.
I mean, so I went to McLean, had a wonderful experience there, but I definitely teetered with the fact of like, should I share this? It feels so deeply personal. But at the same time, I think for many years, I had been that, or what I had shown on social media was exactly what we're talking about. This impossible standard, this everything's perfect. You know, I was speaking at different universities across the country and doing loads of things, but at home I wasn't eating or sleeping or able to really function. And I kind of had to have a present moment with myself and say, you know, this is actually very important to share this vulnerability.
I think it's unbelievably generous, you know, to you. And I met you a few years ago and I sort of with awe and admiration watched your career and, you know, love the way you were relating to younger people and talking about sex and, you know, a lot of like answering questions and sort of being able to have these conversations that people, you know, young people especially didn't feel comfortable having. And I can only imagine the pressure to kind of then be this picture of perfection and the act of generosity of yours to share the challenges and how hard it's been. And I think when we actually see our role models or, you know, just people who we admire. And we tend to put people on pedestals all the time and just then assume that everything is perfect for them. Angela Duckworth is a woman I admire a lot. She is at the University of Pennsylvania and she has done all this research on grit. And so I was having a really hard time finishing my book. And she was like, come on, Sam, you can do it. You can do it. And I'd assume that Angela would have like literally like in her sleep, she could have like rolled over and written this amazing book. Her book is unbelievable, called Grit. And I just imagine it would just kind of flowed out of her effortlessly, like over the course of 2 weeks. And she did it. And she said, like, she sent me this wonderful email saying, like, you don't understand, Sam. I was crying every day. I was so upset and sad throughout this. And you think it was so perfect? Let me show you my bare bones proposal for my book that I sent to a publisher. And I was imagining this like perfect proposal. And it was really bare bones. Like it was like super basic and not that, you know, thrilling. And she's like, no, so I had to really go back and revise that and revise that. And I have to say, as a friend and somebody I'd really admired, it was so generous of her to share that and to kind of pull the curtain back a bit and say like, wait, like this hasn't been this sort of smooth sailing, you know, that duck like skimming across the pond, like my legs were going madly beneath me and I was out of breath and I, you know, almost keeled over. And I think it's nice and it's generous when we see that and we catch glimpses of it. And I admire the way, you know, you've been so generous with it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I feel more connected to even my friends after sharing that experience. And even just strangers, like people will now reach out saying, you know, oh, I spent time in a psychiatric program or I'm on medication. Mental health is slowly getting destigmatized. There's been just a massive shift, I think, even just in the past like 10 years, I notice. I mean, I grew up in a household where mental health was not talked about at all or normalized. Was it talked about in your family? Did you ever see a therapist when you were young?
I did when I was in college. I really appreciated actually going and actually just kind of having that like ritual and having an adult I could have a conversation with and trust and who could hear me outside of, you know, my family, that it would just seem so scary. And I think I was never diagnosed then, I think, as having depression, but I was really down. And I think I would have really just dark periods. And, you know, it was hard for me. And I was really lucky to have that therapist through there at that period. And then really on and off since, like I've been in therapy and I love being in therapy. And I think it's been an incredibly powerful way for me to understand the world and the people I love. And, you know, for me to kind of sometimes see a different perspective or gain some insight into what was going in my head or the things, you know, somebody had taught me this is it's not always what the person says in the session. It's sometimes what they don't say. And I think sometimes in therapy, we can try to like be really entertaining to somebody or be really funny or like you want your therapist to like you or, you know, whatever those things are and kind of getting past that. And I'll say this to my patients, and I know this for myself as well, is sometimes when you don't like your therapist, like before you walk out the door and say like, this isn't working for me, there might be something that it's touching on right now that is making you just react and feel like you want to shut it down. And it might not even be obvious to you yet or conscious, but how can you learn from whatever that negative experience or negative feelings you're having with your therapist? And certainly to bring it up and to talk about it, like you're really getting on my nerves right now, or, you know, whatever that thing is that you can communicate over it, because I think it really can open up sometimes even like a deeper conversation.
Yeah. And just general self-reflection and like you're just constantly learning more and more about yourself. You know, you react, or if you have a negative reaction, emotion to something, it's exactly what you're saying. It's hitting a nerve. But why is it hitting a nerve?
I think we have a lot of like feelings about our feelings too, you know, that like I'm not supposed to feel this way. And even though I think of myself as a positive psychiatrist, like I'm a big believer like in negative feelings. Like I was kind of raised in this WASPy family and it was all about like suppressing things and nobody really talked about anything that was uncomfortable. But negative feelings are so important to sit with sometimes, and they're data, you know, like sadness can be like a signal, or it's when you're feeling uncomfortable or upset or frustrated or even despair, like what is that telling you? And there's a lot of research now looking at what they're calling like, you know, emotional granularity, is rather than just feeling like, I just feel bad, or I'm in a bad mood, or I'm upset. Like if you can try to be as specific as you can, like as possible, like really try to kind of hone in on whatever that feeling is and why you're feeling that way. And you can kind of get the contours of the feeling and be like, well, this is probably why I've been feeling that way. I always think of it as like kind of almost like putting police tape around the emotion. And you can really try to figure out what is going on. Why am I feeling this way? Because then it feels less overwhelming and you're much more likely to kind of understand it. And even more importantly, to be able to kind of act on it.
Yeah. Do you feel like the experience of being both a patient and a therapist has affected your practice or made it better, deeper?
I hope it sort of, you know, gives me some empathy. I mean, it's really recommended. It's not required for all psychiatry residents to go to be in therapy. And so when I was a resident, I did find it to be incredibly helpful. Also, when you're seeing tons of different patients, you know, from the emergency room to outpatient to inpatient, it was helpful to kind of sometimes process some of that as well. And have somebody to kind of bounce it off of who also would be very understanding of it. But so I do hope that it's given, you know, me some insight or empathy or understanding about what people are going through, like on top of my sort of classic training in it. Yeah.
Do you ever feel like it gets in the way? I'm just thinking like the quintessential like therapist almost over psychoanalyzing themselves.
Oh my gosh, that's such a good point. Yes. And like also when it comes to like family or, you know, my husband or something, so I'll be like, well, are you doing this because of that? And you're like, just back off, you know? Yeah. And so I do think that that can be, you know, a very, very tricky sort of line that I really try not to cross though, but I think sometimes it just bubbles up.
Yeah. I mean, when you walk through the door at home at the end of the day, do you try to leave like work at the door?
Well, you know, there's been a lot less like, you know, ability to separate, you know, literally, you know, as things happen on Zoom so much though. But I used to almost have this like decontamination ritual, you know, and I would walk and not like look at my phone or not have like my earbuds. Like I would just kind of just exhale. And so I could kind of feel cleansed literally like, by the time I walked in the door. And it's been a lot harder with Zoom and people, I think, coming up with different issues and new issues. But I've kind of tried to even do that, like walk around the block, even if I'm just like coming back in. So I feel like it's like a re-entry moment. I think rituals can be really important with that kind of thing. I've also been really surprised. Some of my patients with anxiety who actually I was really worried about when like lockdown first began, and surprised and heartened by how those who especially had anxiety who then, you know, felt that they were helping some of their friends who never suffered from anxiety, and they were sharing their strategies to deploy. And they, you know, because they had these sort of go-to things that would help them feel better. And they, you know, one of them said to me like, Dr. Boardman, I've been preparing for this all my life, you know, so I've got like, I'm helping my mom out, my best friend who's having like this hard time and whatever. I'm like, no, this is what you need to do. You need to go for a walk in the park, and then you need to go and like take a shower. And these sort of places. Yeah. And you know, that they had those tangible like ways of like, sometimes you just need to like get up, you know, or whatever, that like just physically like embodied health is so important. So, I was really sort of intrigued by that. And also just, I think that sense of being a giver can be incredibly empowering as well.
Yeah. It's so funny because, I mean, I did a dialectical behavioral program. So it was all about behavioral health and, you know, just forcing yourself to jump out of bed, or, oh, you're having a panic attack, stick your face in some ice water. Like almost these extremely basic, like a list of things that you can do when you're not feeling well. And I'm like, how does that get missed? These things aren't taught in school. Like, I'm like, that almost would have helped me so much more than like figuring out the degree inside a triangle.
You know, but it's so true. You know, like that's like kind of how to be a human being, like how to kind of get through a bad day, that I wish there were like that was embedded into every curriculum, you know, that you could actually like, yeah, maybe you do need to like, you know, wear a rubber band on your wrist and snap it like when you need to get out of a moment, or maybe you do need to just take a really cold shower, that there are things you can do. And what I really wanted to focus on the book is this idea that like happiness isn't just in your head. Like you've got to, even insight can only do so much for you. And I think there's almost this, in traditional psychiatry, this insight imperialism, this idea that like, oh, once that light bulb goes off and like, oh, I do this because my mom did that. But if it's not changing your behavior, who, you know, like, so what? So actually, what are you going to do about it? And rumination, you know, I think self-reflection is healthy, but I think it can veer into rumination sometimes when we're just like going over the same thing over and over again and worried about what did happen or what could happen or what will happen. And how do you lift yourself out of rumination? And sometimes we even have like friends we ruminate with. And like, I always think like when you're just like going over the same thing over and over again, and you're like, haven't we had this conversation before, kind of thing. And, but how do you move past something? Like, okay, so now what are you going to do about it? You know, how are you going to problem solve? What is going to be the behavior? What's the action you take to lift you out of this? And there's actually a lot of research looking at that. It's called like self-distancing. And it's the opposite of like that self-immerse, like these are my feelings. And even when you're telling somebody like, oh, this is what happened, and you're going through it again and again, you're almost like re-traumatizing yourself. But actually when you say like, okay, what would you tell a friend who had the same thing going on right now? Or what would your future self think? And that kind of immediate, like crystal clear, like, oh, that gives me perspective. I would never tell my friend to do what I'm doing right now if they were in the situation. Like if I were, you know, and you just sort of lift yourself out of yourself and you have this different way of thinking about it. And I think we're all terrible sometimes at thinking about our own problems, but have this clarity when we're thinking about someone else's, and to kind of bring that back to ourselves is a lot more generous, I think.
I wanted to touch a little bit on access to healthcare and mental health care, because I do think that's a really important part of the conversation, what we're talking about today. Do you feel like there is a difference between, let's say, your private practice on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and then when you are teaching at school or when you work at the hospital, and just how you've walked that line in your own life?
Yeah. It's like, I've always had a sliding scale, you know, for people to come and see me, and now on Zoom. And I was doing some of those like groups that were through the state during COVID, and trying to always in my own way, be able to kind of provide access, you know, to at least some of the expertise that I've been lucky enough to develop by being able to go to school and to share it. I think, you know, my goal, my like moonshot would be like, I want to be out of business one day, you know, like I don't want anyone to have to see me. I think if we could embed so much of this information, as you were saying, this really like tangible stuff that could help young people learn the habits of at an early age to help them navigate these challenges. We don't want to shield them from stress, or, you know, to create these sort of bubble wrapped lives that prevent them, because no matter what, they will experience it. And kids we know who do experience trauma at a young age, like it even affects them, like down even like at the cellular level of how they respond to stress, and that they end up, you know, they just respond and they adapt to this more stressed out life and constantly live in this state of stress then. So learning ways to manage stress, to cope more effectively, that I think we could be, and it is essential. I mean, as you say, like those, it's great to, you know, learn how to figure out the angles of an isosceles triangle, but this would be far more practical. And unfortunately, right now we just have this like treatment. So when something bubbles up and a kid's having a problem, there might be a counselor or two for them to see. But what if we embedded this into curriculums where you could learn about not just like how to manage problems, but what are your strengths? How can you use your strengths to navigate a problem? What are the actual skills of resilience you can practice? You know, what are the everyday practices and actions that you can take that even when you're having a tough day, that can actually help you find some goodness within that. And, you know, I think you could even be reading Shakespeare and discussing this kind of thing. Like, I think you can actually, like, maybe it'd be even more interesting to be reading classic works of literature and seeing the strengths of these characters in it, and being able to talk about what would you do in that moment? What strength could that person use right here? And really thinking about, because our attention is something that is limited, and we know that, and we're our attention can so often go to like moral outrage or what's wrong. But I think if we can also then refocus on, okay, what makes me tick? What makes me feel good? How can I do more of that? You know, and I that's kind of what I really try to focus on. I think I'm curious about how these apps are helping people, because I think there is, like, at least it making it affordable. For me, always the engagement part is the hardest. Like, people will start one of those like anxiety reducing apps and then they'll get bored. We need to partner with people who are in gaming to make this more interesting, because then you'll like sustain it. Like, if it becomes fun, like, how do you power up in some way and manage your anxiety? Because otherwise people so typically drop off after about 10 days.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like the building blocks, the foundational blocks of living like a healthy and fulfilling life. I mean, the thing that popped up to me is even just being able to name and identify your emotions is such a huge one, particularly in men. I'm thinking about like some of the guys I've dated in the past. Like, that is a building block on how to communicate. You have to know what you're feeling so you don't just run away from it or act out in other ways. And I'm like, this is, and if you're not getting taught this at home, or you come from a family where these things aren't talked about or it wasn't taught to them, then yeah, it's like, okay, is it the school system that needs to pick up the weight? And just so many interesting things to think about.
Now, sometimes I tell people, I'm like, break out a thesaurus. Like, what word is that? You know, I was feeling really lazy during COVID, and like, just like, I couldn't really get anything done, and just feeling like I was spinning my wheels. And my husband, who's German, was like, that sounds like a Geweineschund or something. Like, it was some weird German word that only the Germans would have a word for feeling like lazy and guilty and just kind of down at the same time. And I was like, yes, that's how I feel. But, you know, it was sort of nice to kind of put a word on it. And then you're like, okay, I get this now. And it's kind of become slightly more digestible than rather than that generalized good, bad. And we have this sort of binary bias. I think we think like you're either good or bad, and you can actually hold a lot of emotions together or even side by side. And sometimes even people who are grieving, you know, like they'll laugh and then they'll cry, and they might laugh like through tears, or they'll cry as they laugh. But there's something that is really important, I think, about that almost emotional education and that emo diversity that we allow ourselves to even find the nuance within how we're actually feeling.
Yeah. And how it influences like your thought patterns and what you decide, like your ability to go to school and then what career you choose and just like who you are as a person and your values, your morals. I think it really starts with, yeah, how you're feeling.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And when you're fear driven and you don't even know how to label that stuff, there's often that kind of fear behind it. And then you end up sometimes narrowing your world and shutting off experiences or even opportunities out of that. Because I think sometimes people, like if you're living at zero and your fear is to go to -1, or you're living at zero and you're going to go to +1, like how do we get people closer to that +1?
How has life been kind of re-entering the world from being stuck at home? It looks like, are you back in your office?
Yeah, I'm not back in my office. I've been back in there. Now I'm in the city and at home, but I love being in the office. Like I love having like interaction. I have this like amazing woman I work with, and I love being with her and just kind of bouncing ideas off of each other. So I've really missed that. There are other really convenient things that I've liked about being at home and having like a kind of different rhythm too, but I love New York City. I'm not giving up at all on that. I think New York City is vitality. And it's just what I really miss the most about kind of lockdown was those random interactions with people, like the people like I would see on the block walking their dog, and I knew the name of their dog and their first name, but I didn't know their last name. I wasn't doing like Zoom cocktails with them or anything like that. But I think those spontaneous interactions we have with strangers all the time are a huge wellspring of vitality, and kind of making those connections is invaluable in our everyday lives. And I'm really glad to be having those back a bit.
Do you have any advice for people who are maybe struggling to kind of get back into the swing of things?
Yeah. I mean, I think avoidance is really, really tempting. And, you know, if you're feeling safe, and obviously it has to do with, you know, your comfort with being in a social context, but avoidance is tempting, but it actually, avoidance only begets avoidance. And that can kind of narrow your world if you feel like retreating into that cave. I know a lot of people who've had like sort of social hangovers, like they decided to like kind of go whole hog and we're like, I'm out there again. And we're saying yes to everything. And that's not good either, because we haven't used these social muscles in so long. They've kind of atrophied, and maybe people don't even know what to talk about anymore other than like what's on Netflix. But so it's going to take a while to, I think, get that back to normal again. But here's what, like, my two words of advice, like, really pick and choose what you say yes to. You know, if it's a small group, like no more than six people together who you're close to, say yes to that stuff. Maybe you can pass for now and those like bigger things that might feel a little bit more depleting, and find any opportunity you can to have meaningful conversations.
Yeah, that's great advice. And even what we were talking about earlier, like putting the phone down and putting it in your purse when you're with someone and just trying to be especially present.
Yeah. I mean, make the most of those social interactions. Like, I have some patients who are like, you know, hesitant with reentry, and they're, you know, like even just going for a walk in the park with somebody or around, you know, just kind of side by side, no phones with you or in your pockets. And that's kind of side by side, I think synchronized movement can be incredibly bonding and meaningful. And it is, it's like, it's beautiful weather now, you know, and even when it's not beautiful weather, like bundle up and be outside. And then you're getting the added benefit of, you're getting some exercise, you know, you're getting fresh air and being in nature. Like, that's the hat trick of like some joy in your life.
Earlier, just as we kind of round things down, earlier we talked about just these social pressures, and specifically you were saying you had a lot of pressure on yourself when you were young and in school. Now kind of re-entering the world and as things open up and there's events again, and I know you're very involved in like philanthropy and just stuff going on in New York. Do you feel like COVID has given you a little breath of fresh air? Kind of what you were saying about skipping with your daughter, like not caring so much about what others think.
Yeah. I mean, even I put it this way, and I've really taken this to heart, is a friend of mine had said, well, you know how, you know, you'll have an allergist who only will tell you to like go on a food elimination diet and then only add back in the foods that don't make you feel sick. Like, do the same thing with your social life. Like, you've basically been on a social elimination diet, only add back in the things that make you feel good. And I think there's really some, you know, truth in that. And it's really helped me kind of reevaluate what were those things on autopilot that I would just be like, yes, yes, yes to. And sometimes there are things that we just do out of routine that we never even pause to question. Like, is this meaningful to me? Is this enjoyable? Like, is this something that actually reflects my values? And one thing, and I really do think I have to walk the walk here, is when I get new patients, I'll say, like, let's think about, what do you value most in your life? Like, what are the top three things you really care about, that like what you stand for, what is most meaningful to you? And then, okay, how do you spend your free time? What do you do on a Saturday? What did you do this past Saturday? Tell me about it. And, you know, kind of even trying to make this pie chart of how they're spending their time. And what we know is that I think when there's more overlap between what you care about and actually what you do, you're going to be more resilient. You're going to feel stronger. You're going to feel less depleted, even in the face of daily stress. So, you know, again, like, I'm taking this to heart. How do I walk my own walk? How do I feel that the actions I'm taking and the way I'm spending my free time is a direct reflection of what I value most?